Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast number 35. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a movie from the 60s and a movie from the 70s. The 60s movie is the 1963 Roger Corman directed science fiction thriller X, The Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland and Diana Vandevliss. And then we're going into the late 70s for a little bit of telekinetic action with Brian De Palma's The Fury, starring Kirk Douglas, Andrew Stevens, and Amy Irving. Should be a good show, so sit back, relax, and I'll get the contact details out of the way.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show.
Hi, how is everybody? We're doing fine here. It's winter time, but we're getting abnormal bits of warm weather, which is of concern to everybody except apparently our federal government, which is definitely a river in Egypt when it comes to information about climate change or the economic needs of poor people. But that's all the politics I'm going to do for this episode. I hope you're all doing well there. I should let you know that if this podcast sounds different, it's because I'm using a different mic setup. I'm not using the headphone mic that I've previously used. I'm using my Samsung Meteor on the end of a microphone stand with separate headphones, so it may sound different. I hope it doesn't sound any worse. I was a little unhappy with the way the last couple of podcasts have sounded, so I thought I'd move things around, see what I can do to rectify that self-diagnosed problem. The other hardware news around here is that Sal gave me one of her old laptops and worked for a little while, and then it suddenly balked itself. So I tried for about a week to get this thing working. It's one of those horrible laptops that doesn't let you go into the BIOS and change things. So I was going to basically turn it into a Ubuntu laptop, but that didn't work. And so I've done the ultimate thing, which in this case is I've got a hard drive enclosure and I've taken the hard drive out of the computer, reformatted it, and I'm using it as a 500 gigabyte external hard drive for me to carry around media with. So it's not a total loss, but I'm a bit pissed off about it. I think that if you buy a computer, you really should be able to fuck around with it as much as you like. It's one of the problems I've got with Apple products. But yeah, so live and learn on that one. I think we're going to be a bit more flexible in future on the hardware we buy and only get computers that make it a little bit easier for you to control how you use what you own. Having said that, of course, I've got a special deal with work where I'm getting myself an iPhone. I've already got a Samsung Galaxy phone, but they gave me such a terrific deal. I work for a telecommunications company, and they gave me such a fantastic deal on getting a new phone where it works out at about $3 a month with a ton of data and all sorts of other things that I thought I'd get myself an iPhone. And I'm going to use it for two things predominantly. The first one is I'm going to use it for the data and tether it to my other devices so I can, wherever I am, I can get online and do things that I want to do with my tablet computers and things like that. The other thing I'm going to do with it is I'm going to use it for voice recording and get some recordings of various friends and things for the podcast so I can use it kind of like an interviewer phone and use the pretty good microphones on the iPhone to do some voice recordings with some people for the podcast. So there is that. Now, what have I been watching? two big blockbuster movies have come out since last we spoke here in Australia. I did see Gojira, Godzilla, to those who are uninitiated. And, yeah, it was pretty good. Sal came in with me, and we saw it in 3D, and the 3D works pretty well. I think they're fine-tuning the 3D on a lot of movies really well and making them more accessible. Yeah, the human side of it's a little bit meh, apart from Bryan Cranston. But the big boys there, the other kaiju are there, and even though, of course, as a lot of people have said, the other kaiju do owe a little bit to the Cloverfield monster, it still works well, and cities get trashed, even though it is San Francisco, a city that I like a lot, that predominantly gets trashed. It's still good to see the big guy out there pulling out all of the stops, including his secret weapon, and beating up on lesser and naughtier kaiju. So we saw that. And last night, after work, I went and saw X-Men The Days of Future Past, which is kind of good, and it works. Well, the ensemble works again. Fassbinder is pretty good in it. McAvoy's good in it. Hugh Jackman gets naked in it, so that's a big thing for a lot of people. And it kind of undoes the damage from the last X-Men The Last Stand movie, which is kind of good, and it lets the franchise move forward into whichever direction it wants to. In spite of the fact that it does have a large ensemble cast of mutants, there's still the focus on the three big ones being, in this case, Jackman, McAvoy, and Fassbender. But it kind of works. The effects are beautiful. The guy playing Richard Nixon doesn't look a hell of a lot like Nixon, but you can't have everything. And Jennifer Lawrence really doesn't get to bring her A-game acting to the franchise, unfortunately, playing Mystique. So there is a bit of that. It turns into a little bit of a sausage fest in some ways. But it's not bad. It's definitely not bad. But I'm just trying to work through in my mind why this movie wasn't as great as The Avengers, for instance. Yeah, they're two different kinds of franchises in some ways, but I think there's something that the Marvel Cinematic Universe brings to the game that the X-Men franchise doesn't quite. I think that, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, let me know if you know what it is, because I'm curious to find out, but there is something a bit more in the Marvel Cinematic Universe than there is in the X-Men one, which kind of, yeah, it's an intellectual exercise that I'm going to dive into, and if I have any great insights, I'll let you know. But there is, as I said, a lot more in the MCU. Speaking of which, the new trailer for the Guardians of the Galaxy came out, and it kicks ass a lot. You get to hear Groot going, "I am Groot," and there's a little more of Rocket Raccoon in there, and it does look really great. One of the interesting things I found out about this, and I did mention it on Facebook, back in the 1970s, an artist called Chris Foss did some very, very good science fiction book cover art, mostly for English editions of books, and it was kind of way out there. It was beautiful stuff. And James Gunn and the mob who are doing the Guardians of the Galaxy actually engaged Chris Foss to design some of their spaceships for them, which I like for a number of reasons, one of which is I like Chris Foss's artwork, and I like the spaceships he does. And another thing is that these guys in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, particularly James Gunn and his team, know the good shit in the genre, and they're willing to go out across to England, find the guy who made them, who's to a certain extent marginalised in the genre for no good reason, and they've engaged him to design some of the spaceships for them, which is very, very cool, and all credit to them for that. So what else have I seen apart from those great big tentpole kind of movies in the genre realm? Let me have a look through there. To be honest with you, I've just looked through the list, and I've been doing a lot of non-genre stuff. I've been dipping into my French crime movies a little bit much, and a few documentaries and stuff like that. But apart from the two films of which I will speak today, haven't seen a lot. Now, the two films I'm going to talk about this podcast are 1978's The Fury, starring Kirk Douglas and Andrew Stevens and Amy Irving, directed by Brian De Palma, and Roger Corman's X the Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland, Diana Vandervliss, and Don Rickles. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, as usual, we're going to do things chronologically, and I'll talk about X the Man with X-Ray Eyes.
August 14th, notes on experiment designated X. Experimental subject, myself, James Xavier.
X, the most fantastic experiment you have ever taken part in, presents Ray Milland in his most challenging role since his Academy Award-winning Lost Weekend. X, the man with the X-ray eyes.
Are you all right? It's like a splitting of the world. More light than I've ever seen. Filled with light.
X, the man with the X-ray eyes, tries to help the most desperate in our society and enjoys all the delights of secretly studying sexology.
Headache?
No, it's just my eyes.
A doctor with the power to see what others cannot believe. He can overcome the unknown, save lives, and invade the glamour gambling casinos of Las Vegas and defy the goddess of chance.
Don't draw. Don't draw. The next card's a face card.
And Harry, you better go for the sheriff right now.
Okay, so it's 1963, and Roger Corman's making a movie called X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes. Roger Corman's got an idea that he wants to do a movie about a guy with X-Ray Eyes. So his original thought is he's going to do a movie about a jazz musician who takes too many drugs and eventually ends up with X-Ray Eyes. But that's not really going to play too well. So he got a science fiction writer called Ray Russell and an old friend of his called Robert Dillon, who was a more experienced screenwriter. Ray Russell had just come over to the West Coast from Chicago area and he'd been the fiction editor for Playboy magazine. So Ray Russell came over. He did a bunch of good screenplays, things like Mr. Sardonicus. He wrote the screenplay for that. So he got together with Robert Dillon and did a screenplay about a doctor. Now, this movie is one of the most interesting of its type for a single reason. The mad scientist in it doesn't really break many laws. He kind of does some unethical things in a surgery, and he is part of an accident where one of his friends falls out of a window, and he also cheats at Las Vegas. But apart from that, he doesn't really do anything to anybody else that's at all negative and nasty, which is kind of an interesting way to go about this. So I'll see if I can find a nice little précis of it, and we'll kind of go from there. The IMDb one's a bit succinct. A doctor uses special eye drops to give himself X-ray vision, but the new power has disastrous consequences. There's a storyline here by a guy called Brennan Storr on IMDb. It says, Dr. James Xavier is a world-renowned scientist experimenting with human eyesight. He devises a drug which, when applied to eyes, enables the user to see beyond the normal realm of sight, ultraviolet rays, etc. It also gives the user the power to see through objects. Xavier tests this drug on himself when his funding is cut off. As he continues to test the drug on himself, Xavier begins to see not only through walls and clothes, but through the very fabric of reality. He's got the timeline a bit mixed up in that place here because Xavier tests the drug on himself before his funding is cut off. But, leaving that aside, it's not a bad little way of looking at it. Now, as a science fiction fan, particularly a science fiction movie fan, there are a lot of little steps towards you becoming the kind of science fiction geek who ends up doing a podcast about it. And one of those things is seeing movies at a very early and impressionable age that stay with you all the rest of your life, and unless you go totally senile, in which case all bets are off. But allowing for that possibility, this is one of the movies that I saw very early on that taught me that science fiction films were extremely groovy. These movies took the everyday world and twisted it just that little bit in one aspect of it and showed us real strangeness, which is something that TV series have done as well. Things like The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits were busting apart the mundane and showing us the slimy guts in the middle of it. And this movie did that for me as well. There are a bunch of scenes in it that really would be attractive to a young boy. There's the scene where Xavier first has the ability to see through clothing, and it just so happens that his lady friend takes him to a groovy party where people are doing the twist and doctors are putting together martinis with scientific accuracy and the amount of vermouth and things like that they're putting in it and all that. And then suddenly he can see through everybody's clothing and he seems to enjoy himself thoroughly by doing so. And yeah, it comes across as a little sleazy because at the time Ray Milland was, you know, in his late 50s, about my age, and glomming on all of these attractive young things who he perceived as naked. Now, this being the 1960s, of course, women would have looked a little bit odd because with push-up bras and all sorts of things like that, nothing would have looked entirely natural. And Roger Corman himself has said that this is one of these movies that he would really like someone to remake. And if they remake it with this scene in it, they're going to have to CGI women's breasts so that they look like they're encased in bras, which is not going to make them as attractive as the little fantasy bit in this movie kind of implies. So there is that side of it as well, which only a person with the kind of devious and filthy mind that I have would even conceive of thinking about. But it's just the way it is, and it's just the way my mind works, that things would look a little bit unusual, the same way that naked women do underwater. Things don't seem the same way they do on dry land, if you know what I mean. But leaving that aside, there are a couple of really good shock bits in this film. The bit where Xavier, who basically goes into a coma for a day or two after his first use of the eye drops, wakes up and sees the people around him. There's a really good scene there which has got a nice little twist to it, which is kind of cool. There are the scenes in Las Vegas, and there is some great dialogue that Ray Milland says about the way he perceives the world, which is really kind of emphasizing how strange his perception of what's around him becomes. And it's a nice little bit of writing by Ray Russell in that part as well. There's some bold bits that Corman does as well. As Dr. Xavier first takes the drops, Corman does a very unusual camera move. He zooms in on the back of Ray Milland's head and then cuts to a scene of kind of veins and arteries and things like that. And it's a point of view, from a third person shot, it becomes a point of view shot of Xavier's by going through the back of his head, which is really an interesting choice and really a bold move, particularly for a movie on, even at that stage, a very low budget. I really like the fact that Roger Corman made that bold move to take that chance on the point of view shot, which could look silly if it was done badly. But it's a really, it shows us that there's more to Roger Corman as a director than might have otherwise been perceived. Now, Corman didn't think this movie was going to be a particularly successful one. He was a bit surprised when it was. There are a couple of things he did to help make it more successful than he really was consciously perceiving it to be. First one was the choice of Ray Milland as a lead actor. Now, Ray Milland in 1945 won the Academy Award for Best Actor for The Lost Weekend, and he was an actor with a lot of skill. He was also known as a director. He directed a couple of smaller movies, and he directed some TV series as well. He was originally a Welshman. He was born in Wales and went to England, got involved in films, and then went over to America and became quite famous in movies there. Comment says he was quite a good actor to work with in a lot of ways. He had to wear some very painful contact lenses at various stages during the production and kind of roll with it as well. He was, to use that phrase that I really like using, and it's become my new favourite phrase when talking about thespians, he was a jobbing actor. He'd been a star for a while. His star had faded a little bit. He got a bit older. He's lost his hair, and in this movie it's not entirely unobvious that he's wearing a toupee. But he was an actor who really had some chops, even though he never particularly worked at it really, really hard. I remember him from a really cool movie starring Marlene Dietrich called Golden Earrings, which you might want to see too. It's a little bit campy and a little bit stage-bound because most of it was filmed on sound stages in Hollywood. But you might want to try to look that one up. It's a little bit of fun from around 1940 somewhere. I forget exactly what date, but Ray Milland was very good in that. He was he went on to do a few other things in the genre as well. You've got to remember him in Frogs playing the Southern Patriarch who helps upset the environment so that all of a old mansion in the bayou gets attacked by very slimy and ugly frogs. That movie also stars Sam Elliott, and it's not one of Ray Milland's greatest moments, but he was in there jobbing as an actor as well. But the movie people most remember him from in his later career, apart from X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes, is The Thing with Two Heads with Rosie Grier, where he plays a white, southern, racist, rich old bastard who gets his head transplanted alongside the head of Rosie Grier. It's kind of a cross between blaxploitation and Frankenstein in a weird and fucked up way. And if you want to have a little bit of fun, you can watch that one. It gets a 3.9 on IMDb, which is kind of interesting, because I would have given it a little bit more than that just because of the audacity of the silliness of having Ray Milland's head on Rosie Grier's body. It's got a few other interesting actors in it as well. Don Marshall's in it, who I remember from Land of the Giants. Roger Perry, who was in an episode of Star Trek. Chelsea Brown, who was in Laugh-In for a while, and then came to Australia and did some TV here in Australia in the 1970s and 1980s, is in it as well. So, and it's got Rick Baker starring as a gorilla in the movie, so you can't really knock that. I'm going to have to rewatch that now. Now that I've talked about it, I'm going to have to rewatch The Thing with Two Heads and just groove on the bad wonderfulness of it all. But again, it shows that Ray Milland was willing to go out there and have a bit of fun as an actor. And in this one, he is very, very good. I think he brings more to the role than the fact that it was a Roger Corman movie with a $300,000 budget and a 15-day shooting schedule, really demands of him. He didn't just catch a check on this one. I think he really did bring some gravitas and genuine pain to the character. And again, it gets back to that thing I said earlier where Dr. Xavier, the only things he does wrong apart from experimenting on himself is he stops another surgeon played by another cult movie favorite, John Hoyt, from making a big mistake in an operation on a little girl. He can see what the problem is, and he can't really effectively communicate that to John Hoyt's character. And so he slashes him across the back of the hand to stop him doing the operation incorrectly. His friend Harold J. Stone, played by Harold J. Stone, a character actor whose face you'll immediately recognize, tries to stop him from leaving, and he throws him off, and Harold J. Stone, being totally uncoordinated, falls out of a window to his death, and of course Dr. Xavier goes on the lam because it's perceived that he killed him, whereas from my point of view I think it was death by misadventure. He was struggling with somebody near an open window, and that's never a recipe for things going well. So, and the only other things, as I said, is at Las Vegas he cheats at a casino, whereas those things are run by the mafia. So, you know, if you're ripping off the mafia, surely you're doing something which in some lights can be perceived as a moral act. But yeah, things don't end well. It's one of those movies where things do not end well for the protagonist, and I blame the preacher. After all of his adventures and being chased by the cops, he staggers into an evangelical tent show and gets the worst piece of advice in science fiction movie cinemas from a character actor called John Dirkus, who gives him a little bit of biblical advice, which does not serve him well. And really, you got to think about what happens after the end of the movie as well. And I'm going to do a spoiler on it. Yeah, the movie, don't worry. The movie is 51 years old. So if I'm giving a spoiler and you haven't seen the film, stop right now, watch the movie, come back to this point in the podcast. When he plucks his eyes out, it doesn't kill him. I mean, plucking your eyes out isn't necessarily something that's fatal. So what happens is Dr. Xavier plucks his eyes out, which, and I'm going to talk about the ending a little bit more in another context in a moment. So, basically, there he is. He's plucked his eyes out. He's tortured by what he sees, and he sees something looking back at him from the center of the universe, which is, as Stephen King has said, is a very Cthulhu kind of old gods, H.P. Lovecraft kind of thing to do. So there he is. He's blind. He's going to jail. So, basically, a guy who is essentially a curious scientist who didn't really deliberately hurt a single human being in the whole lot of the film ends up blind and in jail in Nevada. Now, I don't think that's a nice ending for him. Yeah, it's a bit of a shock ending when you see that process shot of him without any eyeballs. But I think it's a really rough ending for Dr. James Xavier. I really think wish better for him. I mean, maybe it's Ray Milland's charisma, but going through it piece by piece, he didn't do a lot that was really nasty. He was trying to help people in various times, which I'll talk about the ending, then I'll talk about a little bit that happens in the middle of the film as well. The ending, Roger Corman has said that, yes, he did plan an ending for that, where after James Xavier plucks his eyes out, he screams out, "I can still see," which is very, very creepy. But getting back to the middle of the film, when he's on the lam, and everybody in this kind of a film, in this kind of a circumstance, at some stage goes on the lam, he ends up in a carnival doing a mind-reading act, and the guy who runs the carnival mind-reading act is played by Don Rickles, who is very, very good in this film. He plays the character as a kind of variation on the Don Rickles persona, but a lot nastier and a lot darker. And apparently Rickles was very nervous working with Ray Milland and working in a fairly major role in a motion picture, but he does it very well. He's nasty and a total shit, wearing Hawaiian shirts and straw hats, and basically decides that the mind-reading act needs to take it to the next level. And they set up shop with Dr. Xavier as a healer who can kind of diagnose illnesses by looking into people's bodies and things like that. And for the character played by Don Rickles, and I'll just find his name because it's only fair that we do that. His name is Crane. He's a total shit and basically uses what he knows of Dr. Xavier being on the run to try to turn it into cash flow for himself. And there's a real good, deep passive aggressiveness and then outright aggressiveness about Crane, which Don Rickles puts across very well. There's some great just head-to-head scenes with Ray Milland where Don Rickles really does hold his own. A lot of people have said this is his first movie, but nah, he did a lot of television in the 1950s and very early 1960s, and he was also in Run Silent, Run Deep with Clark Gable in the mid-1950s, directed by Robert Wise. And it was a kind of a secondary role, but it's still a significant role in a motion picture. So this isn't Don Rickles' first motion picture, but it's probably, arguably, one of his best roles. He's done a couple of other ones where he was kind of interesting, but this is really the one where it shows that a certain kind of comedian, he did start out as an actor before he did stand-up as well, he did train as an actor, but a certain kind of stand-up comedian, when they turn their hand to dramatic acting, can really surprise you and bring a hell of a lot to the table in that kind of a role. And I think Don Rickles does really well in that as well. So, basically, this is one of the classic Corman films. I like the fact that Corman had six movies either in pre or post-production in 1963. And this one was one of the ones he didn't think would be particularly successful. But one of the things he did was he did a bit of television advertising for it, which the big studios weren't really emphasizing at that stage. Yeah, they used it a little bit, but apart from radio advertising, Corman did put a bit of money into TV advertising, and it seems to have paid off once that initial impetus got there. Word of mouth kicked in, and of course, 1963, you had drive-ins everywhere. You had people going to the cinema as a weekly event, so it turned out to be quite financially lucrative for Corman and his business to make this particular movie. And I like it too. It's one of my, I'd say it'd be one of my 20 favorite science fiction movies from the 1960s, and there are a lot to choose from in that decade. And I also like the fact that it's there's a kind of subtext there in this movie saying that there's a price for scientific progress and sometimes a personal price as well. Dr. Xavier's motives in this film are entirely altruistic. There's no evidence at all that he's doing this for self-aggrandizement. He's already got a great reputation as a doctor, but he's doing this to further his knowledge and to understand better what it is to perceive the universe. He wants to see the universe a lot more clearly than he can with normal human vision, which is, of course, could be considered hubris. But I don't think he's mean-spirited at all, and I don't think he's trying to do it for his own, anything more than his own enlightenment, which can be perceived as selfish, but, you know, either way, I don't think he deserved at all the fate that he ultimately ended up with. And if you heard that background noise was a helicopter flying past, strafing a kaiju somewhere off in the direction of Geelong. But, I like this film a lot. It's, the first time I saw it, of course, was on an old cathode ray television in black and white, but the colour is really eye-poppingly good. Now, there's a little bit at the start where you see a human eyeball and then a human eyeball in a tank of liquid with, of course, dry ice in the bottom of it to make a bubble. Here's my theory about that human eyeball you see at the start of the film. Now, this isn't from Roger Corman, because Roger Corman had a totally different spin saying, why are we seeing this eyeball so much at the start? How about this for an idea? The human eyeball you see at the start of X, the man with the X-ray eyes, is one of Dr. Xavier's eyeballs being studied. Now, I know that eyeballs change colour during the film, but my theory is that somebody's studying Dr. X's eyeball. So there you go. That's the theory I'm going with fairly late on a Saturday night after I've drunk entirely too much coffee. So I'll leave you with that thought, and I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about a different movie which has the best exploding John Cassavetes shot in any film in cinema history, and that is Brian De Palma's 1978 movie The Fury, based on the novel by John Farris.
I won.
What do you mean you won? You did not.
There are no secrets between father and son.
Come on, Dad, you saw it.
Except one.
You have a talent that would shock the hell out of people. But it's a talent that also can be put to good use.
For lovers of the shocking, the suspenseful, and the terrifying, comes a new classic. The Fury.
Read my mind.
Look, I don't know anything about reading minds, all right?
The Fury, an experience in terror and suspense.
They took my son away from me. They needed him, so they just took him.
What the hell have you done to that boy?
Oh, he's being treated like a prince. He is, he's royalty, unique. Chinese don't have one, Soviets don't have one. In all the world, there's no one quite like Robin Sansa, unless it's this girl.
Who's Robin Sansa?
He's a boy your age, with powers like yours.
Powers that build. And build. Until they become the Fury.
I want Gillian Belliver at the PSI facility tomorrow.
It's a frightening power these people have. They can make anybody disappear anytime.
She's a fake.
I'm sending her home. I don't have time to waste on people.
Don't do that to me, Doctor. Don't ever try lying to me.
Gillian? Where is Robin now, Gillian?
What's the matter, Robin?
You know what's the matter.
Stop, Gillian!
That girl's taking my place after you poisoned me!
Oh! Ah!
The Fury is the power that holds the key to all power.
Peter, I was lying before. Robin's not okay. He needs us now.
For lovers of the shocking.
Robin?
The suspenseful.
Please answer me.
And the terrifying.
Robin!
Comes a new classic. 20th Century Fox presents a Frank Yablons presentation.
Don't you recognize your old man?
The Fury. The Fury, a Brian De Palma film. An experience in terror and suspense.
That is an extremely 1970s movie trailer with the dead serious narration and all the rest of it. It really is a piece of work for its time. But, yeah, it does succinctly give an idea about what this movie's about. And, yes, it's about Robin Sands, a teenager with psychic powers who is kidnapped from his father on an Israeli beach in a mock terrorist attack and is held by a ex-friend of his father's, Ben Childress, played by John Cassavetes. The father's played by Kirk Douglas. And he's basically being weaponized by the PSI Corporation, which is a CIA front, so that they can use him against whichever enemies, domestic and foreign, the CIA determines they want to use him for. Robin is held with a very attractive woman called Susan, played by Fiona Lewis, who basically fucks him to keep his loyalty with the help of a psychic research institute run by Dr. Jim McKeever, played by Charles Durning at his most oleaginous. Basically, that's the start of the plot. So Kirk Douglas, the father, Peter Sansa, is a CIA guy. He's kind of a proto-Liam Neeson in Taken. He's got a very specific skill set and he's willing to use it to get his son back. And a lot of the film was taken up with the running, jumping, standing still part of Kirk Douglas's character getting a lead on his son and dodging the people from the spooks who are trying to grab him, if not kill him. So basically, there's a lot of that. One side of it is the chase thing. The other side, too, is that there's a young girl called Gillian Bellaver, played by Amy Irving, who also has psychic powers, and she's starting to be groomed by McKeever and Childress and the rest of them to basically replace Robin, who is becoming unstable. He's becoming psychotic and uncontrollable, and that is a big concern to the spooks who run him. So this movie is directed by Brian De Palma, and De Palma, from a technical viewpoint, does an incredibly good job of it. He uses some really nice depth of field photography with what is called split diopters, which means basically they put a contact lens over one half of the camera lens to make it nearsighted so that the focal point for one side of the camera lens is in the foreground, whereas the rest of it is in the middle or the background. So you get an incredible depth of field. There are shots of things like somebody, Robin's hand drumming on a tabletop, and both his hand, which is in the very near foreground, and his face are in focus. So it gives a kind of eerie depth of field that really does enhance the movie. In fact, there's a documentary attached to the Blu-ray version of this, which Cinema Cult have released in Australia. They're related to Shock Records and Shock Cinema. And they've done a very good job of it too, where the director of photography, a guy called Richard H. Klein, explains depth of field and explains the split diopters. This is one of the extras in a movie that I learned a hell of a lot about movie making from. And it's been a while since I've seen something which does it so well and in such detail to really show me that how some things are done or have been done previously. These days you can do it digitally, but old school in the camera, split diopter work and depth of field work is a really interesting way of bringing us across a certain effect in movies. And I found that extra in the film incredibly valuable and definitely made the Blu-ray version of The Fury worth getting. Now, of course, the movie was directed by Brian De Palma, who again used split diopter very much in Blowout, the movie he did with John Travolta and Nancy Allen a couple of years later. There's some nice stuff on the internet about where split diopters were used in Blowout, so you might want to look that up and just learn a little bit more of that. But it's really interesting stuff. A lot of people have talked about the music in this movie. The music is by John Williams, and it's kind of John Williams channeling Bernard Herrmann doing an Alfred Hitchcock soundtrack. And a lot of people have got a lot of time for John Williams as a movie composer, but I see him more as a parodist. He parodies the style of other people more than having a style of his own. Even the big stuff he did, like Star Wars, is a kind of parody of old Eric Wolfgang Korngold and Max Steiner kind of stuff. Modernized to a certain extent, but still a bit of a parody there. Probably the even the stuff he did like Jaws. Jaws, apart from that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun kind of thing, is a parody of other people's work in the past and of other composers, classical composers, movie composers. John Williams, I think, like several other people, is a little bit overrated because people don't know his influences. Now, for me, Morricone is much better value than John Williams would ever be. And also, there are a lot of other Italian composers like Piero Piccioni and Umiliani and other people like that really do have a lot more to offer than John Williams. And in a way, this soundtrack reminds me of another soundtrack of around the same time, which is the soundtrack to The Black Hole that John Barry did. It's got that same kind of heavy, portentous, ponderous kind of instrumentation and orchestration to it. It's not really one of my favorite soundtracks. I like things to be a little less bombastic than the soundtrack to The Fury and the soundtrack to The Black Hole are. Really, you know, lighten the fuck up a little bit. It's a bit repetitive and a bit heavy-handed from my point of view, but, you know, I'm willing to listen to other viewpoints on that. Then you've got the actors in this one. You've got Kirk Douglas, who at the age of 60 looks really good. He's fit, he's healthy, he's way before Sylvester Stallone turned 60, he was the guy to go to if you wanted a 60-year-old athletic guy to take his shirt off. And he does a number of times in this movie. And he gets to play pretty well, too. On one side, he's playing the kind of proto Liam Neeson spook. But there are a couple of bits when he's hiding out and escaping the bad guys where he does have time for a little bit of lightness and even a bit of comedy about it. When he's hiding out with a Jewish family near the elevated railway in Chicago. A lot of this film was filmed in Chicago and set in Chicago. He does have a nice light comedy touch there, even though things are very serious. His son's been kidnapped, he's on the run and that kind of thing. There's still that kind of little lightness, which the movie kind of needs because otherwise it would be very sort of kind of self-important and heavy. But having said that, it's a good ride too. There is some great camera work, particularly the slow motion work as Gillian escapes from the Institute towards the second half of the movie, which is incredibly well done. It's done with multiple cameras. It's done in slow motion. It really gives a nightmarish quality to her escape from the Institute in a very good way. And there are at least three viewpoint characters during that slow motion escape. There's Peter Samsa, played by Kirk Douglas. There is Peter's girlfriend and one of the scientists working at the Institute, Hester, played by Kerry Snodgrass, very underestimated actress. And then there's Gillian herself escaping. So you kind of switch between three different people's viewpoints in this slow-motion nightmarish running down the street escape from the Institute. And it really is De Palma going the full distance. I mean, he's unashamedly a fan and a follower of Alfred Hitchcock. And he does reference a lot of other movies in a lot of his films. For instance, the shootout on the steps in The Untouchables is a direct homage to Battleship Potemkin, things like that. And in this one, too, he's basically doing what is something that was a little bit of a micro-genre at the time, which is the telepathic people versus the spooks, dangerous adventure film kind of thing. Scanners, which I've talked about on the podcast, is another example of that. And then, of course, there's a movie that De Palma himself did 2 years before, Carrie, again, with that kind of theme. So you've got Kirk Douglas. You've got Andrew Stevens playing Robin the Sun. Andrew Stevens is the son of Stella Stevens, and he's gone on to be a not incredibly successful movie producer in later years. If you look at his IMDb page, you'll see that he hasn't done anything really since 2010. And before that, he was doing kind of asylum / sci-fi channel kind of movies as a producer, which is, yeah, he's got a living, of course. But and the other thing I found about Andrew Stevens while I was researching him online is on YouTube, there is his audition for Star Wars, where he is going to go for the role of Luke Skywalker. And if you ever want to see an actor kind of misjudging what's expected of him in an audition, then you should see that. It's kind of very rough, black and white videotape footage, but you kind of cringe. He's playing opposite Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford's feeding him his lines. And, yeah, just seeing how misjudging he is of what's expected in it is a little bit of a squeamish thing to watch. So you've got him in there. You've got Charles Durney, of course, great character actor. He always comes across, particularly in this film, as somebody who you get the feeling he's got very greasy hands. He's really kind of a slimy arsehole of a character. Then you've got one of the great indie directors of the second half of the 20th century, John Cassavetes, playing Ben Childress, the spook. Now, Cassavetes in this is very good. He doesn't bring a kind of over-the-top intensity to the character, but there's a lot of menace in what he does. And he's very focused and that kind of thing. Cassavetes did a lot of these movies to finance his indie films. So in a sense, he was an honest check casher. He would admit to anybody that the reason he did commercial Hollywood films was to finance his independent projects. And more strength to that, his independent projects are worth more than most of the films he did for the money. So, you know, in that sense, it's a subsidy to the arts. But he's very good in this one too, and has the great climactic scene of exploding when he's blown apart telekinetically by one of the characters. And he does blow up very well. This being a De Palma film, way too much time is taken up with chase scenes and things like that. I think that from our viewpoint, they're a little bit long and self-indulgent, but they still work well. You know where everybody is at any particular time. De Palma was very meticulous in storyboarding, particularly the action scenes in this film. And so they do hold together well. There's no doubt where anybody is and what their motivations and what their actions are in any chase scene in this film, which is a nice change. I mean, I've seen a few action films lately where it still gets a bit confusing about why somebody is and where they are and what they're doing at any given moment in the action scene. A lot of quick-cutting, shaky-cam action scenes suffer from that. But this one holds together well. And also, there's some back projection work that De Palma does in this, particularly when Gillian is seeing what other people have experienced in the past. When she touches hands with somebody, she can see certain things that they've done in the past. And Richard H. Klein is the guy who introduced De Palma during the making of this film to reprojection. And De Palma then went away and created this great tour de force reprojection scene with Amy Irving in the middle of another action scene, but apart from it, because what she's seeing is people's memories of the action scene. And that's kind of cool, even though it is third person, and in reality, if you're seeing something that somebody remembers, you'd be looking out through their eyes and seeing it, even though it is a third person chase in a house that she's perceiving. It is done very well and in a way that hadn't really previously been done in cinema effectively. And there's a nice 360-degree pan in the middle of her experiencing this, which is really top stuff. Now, this of course brings up the other issue that I have with some of De Palma is he's a little bit of a smarty pants when it comes to stuff like this. I know he's trying to tell a story and using certain techniques to tell it, but there's sometimes the impression that he's also doing it to say, hey, look what I can do. And yeah, that kind of audacity can be a lot of fun, but it also questions his motivations on whether he's serving the story or whether the story and the movie are serving to increase his the way people perceive him as a movie maker. That's one of the problems with those kind of shots, where some people do it as a technical challenge and other people do it to draw attention to themselves. And with De Palma, it's sometimes a little hard to discern whether he is actually doing it for reasons that serve the story or reasons that serve him. So, you know, that's an argument you can have about these kind of films. I just took a look through Kirk Douglas's autobiography, The Ragman Son, and this movie does not get a mention at all in anything at all. There's no mention of John Cassavetes in there, Amy Irving, Brian De Palma, nothing. So I'm not sure how well Douglas himself regarded this film and whether he thought it was something worth mentioning in his autobiography or not, but obviously he didn't in this case, which is a little bit of a shame because of his later films, it's one of the ones that's most remembered, particularly by genre fans. And it's a little bit of a shame. It would have been interesting to get his viewpoint on it, but that unfortunately hasn't occurred. So just to summarize on The Fury, it's got some great special effects, including the makeup and prosthetic effects by Rick Baker, who we know from any number of things. The soundtrack, not so much, as I'm not a big John Williams fan, but it's a good, solid action film. It travels along well. It's got some nice character acting pieces, particularly by Douglas, Charles Durning, Kerry Snodgrass, and John Cassavetes. And, yeah, even though it does have that kind of... Well, here's my problem. You've got the ability to kill people with the power of your mind, right? Why would you go to the trouble of making it really gory and bloody and having basically blood splatters all over the place like a crazy Jackson Pollock painting when you can simply pop a blood vessel in someone's brain and make them drop like a puppet with cut strings? Yeah, you need it for cinematic purposes and because it looks spectacular on the screen, but it kind of loses credibility given the impossible stuff of people with psychic powers. There's still got to be the case for doing a movie where people with psychic powers just basically give people cerebral hemorrhages like that without too much visible evidence of it and they just drop. I think that is kind of creepier than having all the shaking, rattling, bleeding from the eyeball kind of stuff. I think that there's a creepiness in just that sudden ending of people that might make an interesting movie in some ways. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. I do recommend, and in spite of all the caveats I had there, I do like The Fury. I think it's very much of its time. I think it's De Palma technically being very brilliant. And I think that any movie that ends with John Cassavetes being blown up by a telekinetic teenager is at least of some interest to people. So having said that, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, there's some feedback.
Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads, a whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo. There was Mermaid Minnie, met her down in Madagascar. She would kiss me anytime that I would ask her. Then one evening, her flame of love blew out. blow me down and pick me up. She swapped me for a trout. Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads, a whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon about. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo. There was Typhoon Tessie, met her on the coast of Java. When we kissed, I bubbled up like molten lava. Then she gave me the scare of my young life. Blow me down and pick me up. She was the captain's wife. Got a whale of a tale to tell you, boys, a whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo. There was Harpoon Hannah, had a face that made you shudder, lips like fish hooks, and a nose just like a rudder. If I kissed her and held her tenderly, there's no sea monster big enough to ever frighten me. Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads, a whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo.
Of course, that was Kirk Douglas singing Whale of a Tale from the Disney movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea from about 1955 or so. Just thought I'd throw that in there, given that Kirk Douglas was mentioned, and it's his only known effort at singing. Yes, so I do have one piece of feedback and a correction, so I got something wrong, and I'm willing to fess up to that, and I've really got no problem doing that at all. And the feedback comes from Mark R. Leeper, and Mark, very big friend of a number of podcasts and very, very knowledgeable in these things. So Mark says, "Hi, Terry, you were telling about Herbert Marshall's background and skipped over the role that comes to mind first for me. He played Inspector Charis in The Fly, 1958, one of my favourite SF films of the 1950s. Yeah, it's one of mine too. I've got it on Blu-ray. I picked up a Blu-ray of it recently, but I haven't had time to watch it yet. So I'm going to dive back into that and have a lot of fun. One of the aspects of the 1958 Fly that I really like too is the fact that a lot of it starts out as a police procedural. Yeah, there's been the murder or suicide of Andre Delhomme, and they kind of go back and try to find out how he died, and then it gets into the plot line of The Fly, which is an interesting approach to taking that. But yeah, Herbert Marshall, definitely an interesting character actor who didn't let a disability slow him down at all, which is, again, something that makes him something of a role model for a lot of other people. And then Mark goes on to say, Gog and Magog are names from the Old Testament. He gave me a Wikipedia link. They may also be Welsh giants, but I've never heard of them in that context. Thank you for one of the most enjoyable podcasts. Okay, yep, mea culpa, I got that wrong. Gog and Magog are names that appear in the Old Testament and in numerous subsequent references to other works, notably the Book of Revelation, as well as in the scripture of Islam, the Quran. So let's have a look at the Wikipedia page, and I'll give you a little bit about Gog and Magog. Let's have a look here. Oh, that's totally crazy. Basically, they were giants in the Old Testament. I had the impression that they were Welsh giants, but I got it wrong. I was just talking off the top of my head and made an error. The Bible, of course. Hang on, wait a sec. There's where I got it from. This is from Wikipedia again. Despite their generally negative depiction in the Bible, Lord Mayors of the City of London carry images of Gog and Magog, depicted as giants, in a traditional procession in the Lord Mayor's show. According to the tradition, the giants Gog and Magog are guardians of the City of London, and images of them have been carried in the Lord Mayor's show since the days of King Henry V. That's where I got it from, because in the Royal Car Arcade here in Melbourne, you can go to the Wikipedia page for Gog and Magog. You can see the Gog and Magog pictures in the Royal Arcade here in Melbourne, where they kind of loom over a clock in the arcade. Let's see, an even older British connection to Gog and Magog appears in Geoffrey of Monmouth's influential 12th century Historia Regum Britanniae, which states that Gog and Magog was a giant slain by the eponymous Cornish hero Corin. So there you go. So that's where I got it mixed up. It's not actually, there are a whole bunch of English things there. but it was Cornish rather than Welsh. There's a Cornish connection there. And in Cambridge, there's a place called Gog Magog Hills in Cambridgeshire. And the reference is in Ireland. There's a Mount Magog, which is the third highest peak in Western Australia's Stirling Range. Stands near Mount Gog, a smaller peak. In Tasmania, there are two hills named Gog and Magog. And in New Zealand, there's a couple of granite domes called Gog and Magog as well. So it's all over the place, this stuff. And I got it wrong. I'm willing to confess to that. I did get it wrong. And thank you very much, Mark, for correcting me, because I wouldn't have known if you didn't correct me. And I'm learning stuff is what this is all about. So that's about it for the feedback this time around. I've got to find a question to pose to people, because questions to pose to people are always a bit of fun at the end of a podcast. And let me think for a moment. I'm going to stop the recording, take a sip of coffee, and have a think about this. Okay, I've got one. Now, we all know that Metropolis is the elephant in the room when it comes to silent era science fiction movies. And the other one that really comes to mind is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So apart from those two silent science fiction movies, what is your favorite silent era science fiction movie? For me, it's probably Paris Qui Dort, where the whole city of Paris falls asleep, except for some people who are at the top of the Eiffel Tower. It's a really interesting old silent one. I think it is on YouTube, but I find it kind of charming. And I like seeing Paris as it was in the 1920s, and it may even have been a René Clair film. Give me a moment. I'm going to check this out. Yep, this time I was right. It's a René Clair film from 1925, and it is a lot of fun. It's not a particularly long movie. It runs 35 minutes, but here's the plot summary from IMDb. The film is about a mad doctor who uses a magic ray on citizens, which causes them to freeze in strange and often embarrassing positions. People who were unaffected by the ray begin to loop Paris. And it's got Albert Préjean in it, amongst other people. And I really think that you should try to find a copy and check it out, because it is a little bit of interest. So that would be, apart from the obvious elephants in the room with silent genre cinema, that would be my go-to silent era science fiction film. So having said that, it's time for me to wrap this up. Have a good time in the next few weeks while I'm not here, because I am going to Continuum, the National Science Fiction Convention here in Melbourne, and I've got to record the next episode early. I'm going to try to get maybe I'll get an interview with a couple of people or something like that for the podcast while I'm there. So I'll chuck a few of those things into the next podcast. But one, next podcast around, I'm talking to Ian Triffitt about a 2011 movie called Detention, which is a kind of a cross-genre mashup between horror, science fiction, and a bunch of other stuff. So I'm recording that tonight, but we're going to put it into the next podcast. So anyway, look after yourselves in the next 2 weeks. Watch some great movies and keep watching the skies. And I'll be back soon with something else.